U.S. Senate seats don't open up all that often. For starters, the terms last 6 years, and Vermont has a habit of re-electing its incumbents. In fact, the last U.S. Senator from Vermont not to win re-election was Ernest W. Gibson Jr., who served less than a year and retired in 1941 after replacing his father, who died in office. The Senate is sometimes referred to as the cooling saucer of democracy. Why? Here's Middlebury political science professor Bert Johnson.
I think philosophically, it is supposed to be the more deliberative branch. People call it the world's greatest deliberative body. And that is, it's supposed to cool down the hot heads of the House of Representatives, the House being the more popular branch, and facing re-election more often.
Right now, the U.S. Senate is evenly divided. 50 senators who caucus with Democrats and 50 who caucus with Republicans. It's the longest the Senate has ever been evenly divided, and at a time when Congress has reckoned with a pandemic and subsequent financial crises.
So one thing that the 50-50 Senate does do is it makes every single vote extremely important. So you had people fighting for the vote of Joe Manchin, the pivotal senator on the Democratic side especially, who wanted some special things for West Virginia and more or less was able to get them. So it's important to get every single vote in the Senate in a way that it hasn't historically been in the House, nor has it really been in the Senate until the last couple of years.
This year, 34 out of 100 U.S. Senate seats are up for grabs, including one of Vermont's. This week, we're talking to the candidates on the WCAX Election Podcast. Welcome to another episode of the WCAX Election Podcast. I'm producer Brett Miller, here with political reporter Calvin Cutler.
Hi, Brett.
Calvin, welcome. This week we are talking about the Vermont Senate race. Who will replace longtime Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy? Tell us about these candidates, Calvin.
Right. So Congressman Peter Welch, he's a household name in Vermont. He served many years in the Vermont State Senate. He was a Vermont Senator President pro tem, and he also served in Congress, elected back in 2006. So he's been in the public sphere for some time. His challenger is a relatively new face in Vermont politics and in Vermont generally, too. His name is Gerald Malloy. He is a U.S. Army veteran. He served many decades as well in the private sector, working with defense businesses and working with the Defense Department as well. Moved here in 2020 during the pandemic, and he lives in southern Vermont.
And WCAX has new polling numbers on these candidates. Is that correct?
They do, Brett. So this was a poll that was commissioned by WCAX, administered by the University of New Hampshire, and it really confirms what many political observers had already been saying, that Peter Welch was the favorite. If the election was held this week, Peter Welch would capture 62% of the vote compared to Gerald Malloy's 28%. And it's worth pointing out as well that despite all of the deploy Malloy signs, and Gerald Malloy has also been out on national media, on Fox News and others multiple times, there's a good chunk of Vermonters who still don't know who he is. 43% of Vermonters said that they don't know who Gerald Malloy is as of right now. So there's definitely some ground to make up. But as we said, Congressman Welch is the favorite heading into November.
All right. Well, let's hear from the Senate candidates. And we are here with Gerald Malloy, Republican for U.S. Senate here in Vermont. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Brett, and thank you, Calvin. It's great to be here.
What do you believe are the top issues motivating voters as they head to the polls this fall?
Sure. I've been on the campaign trail now since January, actually, and the absolutely top issues Vermonters are concerned with are the economy, crime, and drugs. And I've got some ideas to address those with the economy. I'm sure you just saw the recent inflation report, 8.3%, I think it was this time. We're in a recession. We've had record high gas prices, and that's been, you know, a cause of the decision to kill the oil and gas industry. And so it's hitting Vermonters' pocketbooks, and it's not looking good for the future, as our national debt now just went over $31 trillion. And so there's also a drug crisis with fentanyl and a crime crisis, because we've undermined our law enforcement community over time. And the crime is growing across Vermont. It's getting much worse, even in Burlington. So those are the three top issues.
What is an under-the-radar issue that you might be focused on that perhaps people aren't talking about or people aren't thinking of right now?
Well, a couple, I would say, are veterans' benefits. I'm a veteran, and I'm looking to improve veterans' benefits, improve processes to get service at the VA. I think the VA does a great job, but I think there's room for improvement there. I would also say another one. I had a great meeting with the Bi-State Primary Care Association. So healthcare for lower and moderate income Vermonters, the funding for that, we need to, I'm looking to continue funding for that. That great program serves upwards of 200,000 Vermonters, 88 sites over the state. Had a great meeting with that organization a couple of days ago. And, you know, healthcare has got to be at the top of the list always to ensure, you know, our Vermonters are taken care of.
Abortion is another issue that's expected to impact votes this November. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, he introduced a bill to ban abortion at 15 weeks nationwide, with some exceptions. Would you support that legislation?
No, I would not. And that's, I will tell you the background on that. As I announced my candidacy, I talked about thinking that per the Constitution, 10th Amendment, that Roe v. Wade should be overturned, that decision belongs at the states and the people. That's what happened. And it is at the states. It's a state issue. And I'm looking to be a United States Senator and represent Vermont, not control Vermont. I believe that issue belongs at the states. So, you know, sweeping Senate legislation, I'm not in favor of that. That's a state issue. That's where it belongs. That is where I believe it should stay. And I, for instance, have talked about, you know, for me, I am pro-life. However, and I will impact, you know, through my beliefs with my one vote as a Vermont citizen. For instance, we got Prop 5, Article 22 coming up on the ballot here in November. I will vote no against that. And I recommend all Vermonters take a good hard look at that proposition and think about what it says in terms of state's compelling interest and even, you know, even a greater issue where we have a constitution that I think represents the values of its people. And in this case, when you consider third trimester abortions, that's not a value of most Vermonters and most Americans. So I don't think that should be enshrined into the Vermont Constitution. So I'll be voting no against that. Thank you.
This past summer, I want to clarify, this past summer, in an interview with NBC5, you said that you would support a national abortion ban. What made you shift your position?
Well, that was Roe v. Wade had not been overturned at that point. And I talked about, you know, when I thought that it should be, it had not been at that point. And that's why I said that. What has led me to the answer I just gave you is that I'm looking to be a United States Senator. And I believe in the Constitution. I've served under the Constitution well over two decades. It's the exact same oath as an officer that a U.S. Senator takes. And I believe per the Constitution, that right, given elsewhere within government, belongs at the states. That's where it is. That is what happened. So I would support that.
Governor Phil Scott has had success in Vermont by appealing to moderates in the Republican and Democratic parties alike. Is that a playbook that you're going to be following as well?
Well, I appreciate Governor Scott's great leadership of Vermont as a Republican governor, and I do look at I do need to attract moderate voters across the state to be successful here, and I think I'm all on the path to doing that. And the reason for that is, I think Vermonters have been campaigning, as I mentioned, since January. I call it about 85% of Vermonters are not happy with the direction the state is going in and the country's going in, and this, the national debt and the massive overspending many different policy decisions, and even that overspending has been misguided in a lot of ways. So I think Vermonters see that, and they're willing to make a big change here, change for a better future. And there's even the background of the history here in the state. Before Senator Leahy won in 1974, only Democrat senator ever in the state of Vermont. Vermont had 100 years of straight Republican Senate leadership. And even the time frame, 1974 to here, some of the issues that were going on back then, coming out of Vietnam, the oil embargo, inflation, recession, and a president that resigned literally weeks before Senator Leahy took over or won by a small margin, that kind of flipped that. I think we're in a similar situation here. I think the country sees we need to change direction towards a brighter future, because we're not on a sustainable path with this overspending. And frankly, this might upset some people, but I think the Democrat Party has been hijacked by the progressive left, and that's not the direction, that's not leading the country in a good direction right now. And that does include my opponent.
What do you believe are the biggest differences between you and Governor Scott, who at this point to Vermonters is kind of a known quantity? Where do you differ from him?
There are some issues. I'm pro-life, and he has supported, I believe, Prop 5, Article 22. I do not. That's one. But I got to give a lot of credit to, a great amount of credit to Governor Scott. I think he had upwards of maybe 12 vetoes in this past legislative period, maybe even a Vermont record. So he's standing up and making the tough decisions. And that's what I talked about in the debate I just had with my opponent. What's missing, I believe in our federal government is leadership and performance and common sense and discipline. And really one of the big things that's missing is clear politicians not willing to make tough choices. I'm willing to make the tough choice, not a career politician, willing to make tough choices for a better future. I do see Governor Scott doing that on a daily basis, and I appreciate it, as all Vermonters do.
You're a relatively new figure in Vermont politics. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you landed in Vermont?
Sure. Was fortunate to be accepted to West Point, which was a childhood dream, and I played a couple of sports there, hockey and baseball, but went to West Point. It was a great experience. I wanted to become an Army officer, and I was, and I served active Army 22 years all over the world, Germany, including nuclear surety positions, Korea a couple of times, Middle East, and then I was in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. I led the operations of a multiple launch rocket system battalion over about 400 kilometers, firing 650 MLRS rockets. So that was it's a game changer system. You hear about it today in the follow-on next generation with HIMARS and Ukraine. But after the military, I worked for about 5 years in government positions and with government across a wide spectrum of government organizations, law enforcement community. Then I went into business, and last 11 years plus, I've been in a very competitive business environment. I've been in business development positions and been responsible for growing new business for the organizations I support. And that's been mostly across U.S. government agencies and organizations, including the Department of Defense. Extremely competitive. Extremely cost competitive, operating under the rules they call organizational conflict of interest. So I've operated under those rules, and you see some of that even with our congressman today. But success, performing, and growing business. And I looked.
Sorry to interrupt you. What kind of businesses are we talking? Business is so broad. That could be.
Sure. Yeah, that mostly defense, supporting defense agencies with, let's say, an Army organization needs 50 people to do an engineering services project. I will compete in that against many other companies to provide that service. It's very cost competitive. There's usually there's always a technical piece of that you present to the customer and a cost you present to the customer, and they do an evaluation, make a choice. The reason I was going to say I've been successful there is based on engaging customers and listening to their issues and problems and requirements, and then developing that solution with my company or with a team. and presenting that, and ideally having the honor of winning work to support that organization and performing. I think that translates into supporting and serving Vermonters to grow well-paying jobs here in Vermont. I think that has been missing. It is missing in Vermont, and that's one of the top priorities I look to do in terms of my platform, abiding by the Constitution, promoting economic prosperity, and ensuring defense, security, and order. That's one of the top ones. And the economy piece is growing well-paying jobs in Vermont, and I think that's Vermont needs that. It's been missing.
What brought you to Vermont?
Well, I've moved about 17 times in my life, and at that 17th move, my wife and I had thought about, we're both from Massachusetts. I was born in Dorchester in Boston, and we both looked at some different places. I will tell you, Vermont was at the top of the list. We've both been coming up here our entire lives, and my opinion, no offense to any other state, it is the most beautiful state, four-season state in the country, and we absolutely love it. I love our brave little state, and I love her people. And I wanted to move here, and I'm glad I did. And it's the best state in the union, in my opinion.
Yeah, I got here in 2018, and I just love it. Yeah. When did you and your wife arrive?
A little over 2 years ago. Yeah.
Nice.
She actually found this lodge right at the beginning of the pandemic, and we bought it and then moved up here. We moved up here, and it's been great.
So what inspired you to get involved with politics, and why run?
Sure. Good. Thank you. I was alarmed by the direction our country started going in, and that's literally from day one of the Biden administration. I did not like the executive orders that he implemented right on day one, including to kill the oil and gas industry. We had oil and gas independence. We've given that away, and it's going to have some bad repercussions, I believe, here as we're entering winter, and we've seen the gas prices.
Is the oil and gas industry dead? Because I just filled up this morning.
It's not. It's not dead. But
how could they have killed it?
Well, he put restrictions on development and production, including the pipeline. I think that has had significant impact on the oil and gas industry.
I interrupted you. Sorry there. Go ahead.
that was one piece. I would say the overspending, which I've taken economics at West Point and getting an MBA, and it's a pretty established economic theory. If you keep pumping money into the economy, you are going to get inflation. And here we are, 8-9% inflation. I just saw the recent report that groceries are at 13.5% from last year up. I mean, that's tough. So I saw that. And then I saw Afghanistan. Afghanistan was one of the, I don't blame our military for that, but that was a debacle. The world watched that. Russia watched that. I believe that was a large part of Russia deciding to actually invade Ukraine. And I watched that, and I became further alarmed. And Senator Leahy made his announcement. And that's when that very day is when the thought of me running to be your next U.S. senator came into my mind. And I, as I mentioned, the background there in 1974, I've looked at the elections over the years, I guess going forward to January, February, I went boots on the ground across the state, getting my signatures, and I found Vermonters were ready for change across the board. Like I said, about 85% saw we're going in the wrong direction. The tipping point for me was the State of the Union address. I think that was March 1st, and I watched that very closely and listened to it very closely, and I did not like, I had a very bad feeling. The thought of unrecoverable crossed my mind, and I said, I have to run. I can't stand by and watch. And March 17th, I, through Guy Page and Vermont Daily Chronicle, I made my announcement, and I made the right decision.
According to the 2022 annual report of the Social Security Board of Trustees, the trust fund surpluses that fund retirement, disability, and other Social Security benefits will be depleted by 2035. In your mind, what does the future of Social Security look like?
I'd have to look more at the specifics about Social Security, but what I am concerned about You know, I want to get folks, as I mentioned, well-paying jobs, which will contribute into more into Social Security. What I'm really concerned about is this massive overspending. I think it was over last weekend. We went over $31 trillion, and then we here have our president that has decided with this loan action that's going to add another $1 trillion of debt over time. That massive number, $31 trillion and growing, is heading towards a bad situation where we cannot afford to pay Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and have the budget that we want for our defense. And I'm concerned about going in that direction, continuing to go in that direction. So I look to instill some. And I even talked with, the Bi-State Primary Care Association a couple of days ago, and we talked about the budget. They have their budget for this year. They are, you know, looking to increase. And we had a great discussion about, you know, it's time here in America where we make some tough decisions, you know, and come to the table and find out, you know, where the priorities are, because, you know, not every organization is going to be able to double its budget, you know, next year. The only way to do that would be to massively increase revenues, taxes, and I'm not in favor of that at all. And you know, that gets back to the, you know, adding 87,000 IRS agents. I'm opposed to that, and that's going to cost $80 billion. And there's even, you know, my opponent talked about that being for customer care. And There's some ideas out in the street that that's not for customer care. That's to do more audits on Americans. You know, some of those agents even armed. I did hear something about the.
Isn't increasing tax revenue a worthwhile thing to pursue? So you're saying that you're opposed to tax enforcement?
No, I'm not opposed.
All right,
to tax cause,
enforcement. So wouldn't more IRS agents be a good thing?
Well, I think we're doing, I don't think there's an issue with lower income folks. I'll tell you where the issue might be. If there is some tax issues, it's the complexity of our tax program. So lower income folks to wade through the hundreds, thousands of pages of tax law is difficult. But I believe even going back to the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act, and I saw a report from the IRS that in fact, our tax revenue total has increased, and the taxes for the working class has decreased. I'm in favor of that. What I'm not in favor of at this point in this country, for instance, adding 87,000 new IRS agents when we have many other issues like crime and drugs and the border that need to be addressed more than that.
Healthcare costs continue to increase across the board. If elected as senator, what will you do to give Vermonters access to quality, affordable healthcare?
I've come up with some ideas there. I am in favor of enabling buying insurance across state lines. I am in favor of right to try. I support ongoing actions to reduce transparency so that patients know what their costs are going to be before a surgery or something like that. I'm also, I actually had this discussion with the Bi-State organization. There's a consolidation of healthcare, and I think that's being promoted by the government, and that seems to be actually increasing costs. So I would look at different ways to continue to increase competition. And I think over time that is the answer to lowering healthcare costs.
To what extent, if any, is climate change a priority of yours?
It is. It is a priority, and that climate. I talk about, you know, we're all put here as God's stewards to take care of our earth, and I'm an outdoors person, and I will say I don't believe that we're in a climate crisis or a climate emergency, but it is a serious issue. I think the United States has done actually a great job in lowering our emissions over time. One of the things that I would look to do is we have some other countries that are not. They're doing a horrible job. You know, with China and India, for instance, are not, you know, reaching or moving towards goals to lower emissions to impact the climate. So I would look in terms of maybe some foreign policy or maybe even some sanctions to get other countries to start pulling their weight in terms of lowering emissions.
You've been asked.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Calvin.
No, after you, Brett.
Oh, well, I was going to say is, you know, lowering emissions, good thing, right? What other climate projects? Because it's what you're saying seems to, you know, stray from Republican Party orthodoxy, at least in the Senate. You know, it seems like any climate action that has happened has been, you know, with the GOP kicking and screaming along the way. How do you reconcile those points of view?
I could tell you my view, and I've talked about this kind of throughout the campaign. I look to kind of reevaluate what I am in favor of developing future energy capabilities, wind, solar, electric. What I don't want to do with the American people is to back into that without a plan, without the resources. And the resources might be might call them what we used to say in the Army, the long pole in the tent. If we don't have access or own the lithium and cobalt and manganese and graphite, that's the starting point if we're going to go towards that plan. And we have to get buy-in from the American people on a plan. We can't just say, well, it might be 50 trillion, it might be 100 trillion. We need to have a better plan to do that. We've started the infrastructure. I look, as we've done here in America, for industry to run its course and innovation here in America. I don't look to have more government influence or control on that. I look for industry to come up with the innovation to support that. I think that will happen. That's kind of, those are some of my thoughts, but I am in favor of developing future capabilities, but we do need a better plan to do that. And getting back to my original point about, I don't think the right way to go about that is to take away the oil and gas independence we have, because that is causing the financial hardship that we're all seeing at the pump and with home heating oil, et cetera.
Well, you talked about the decision to kill oil, essentially. Isn't there a finite amount of fossil fuels anyway? Isn't it, whether anybody decides to kill it or not, isn't it only a matter of time?
I don't know the answer to that. Like anything else, you can read a lot of different statistics. I believe that there is certainly enough of that resource that we had the independence with oil and gas for America to support itself for quite a while. The number of years, I don't know. That could be 50, that could be 100. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if anyone does, but at this point, with I think the projections that are out there that we have access to here in the United States, that the one answer is that we don't need to stop using that, you know, immediately and try to, as I mentioned, sort of back into this new Green Deal, for instance.
I wanted to shift a little bit and ask about our democracy. Do you believe that the 2020 election was stolen?
No, I do not. President Biden is the president, and I don't believe it was stolen.
How would you describe the events that took place on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol?
Well, again, I've talked about this quite a bit. I think, for starters, folks that broke the law need to be held accountable. And that's the main issue or an issue. Folks that went in to hear their president talk and exercise their First Amendment rights, I'm all for that. And when you start breaking the law, that's not right. And so I oppose that.
It's fair to say that the U.S. Congress is divided significantly, and there is quite a bit of political division out there. If elected, what would you do to bridge that gap and to heal those political divides?
Well, I'm looking to serve Vermonters and serve the United States, and that means coming up with solutions. And you're right, it is divided, and we're kind of stalemated. One of the things I've talked about is making tough choices, and we cannot, for instance, keep overspending like this. I will say I've been part of what is successful foreign policy in different parts of the world. So I would look to influence that as a United States senator based on my experience around the world. And I would go back even to my business experience, where you develop partnerships, and I think I can do that with senators across the board to make move forward for what I call in the business world a value solution for Vermont and for America. The straight line stagnation, so to speak, in our Congress is not working. So I am going to look to improve that and be amenable to any kind of good idea solution. But I will draw the line at the Constitution, and that's I am going to protect the constitutional rights of Vermonters and all Americans.
Another question that I'm sure you've gotten before. We've all seen your Deploy Malloy road signs out there. What went into the design process for those? And how important is it to have a good slogan?
It is important, and I can't, I think maybe I'm coming up on engaging 15,000 Vermonters over the last 7 months, and a whole bunch of them, that's the first talking point. It's, you're that guy. And so I guess to answer your question, I got fortunate because, interesting story, I made my announcement on March 17th. I think it went out on the air maybe about 8 o'clock in the morning. At about 9 o'clock in the morning, a woman called me and said, "I want to be on your team." And she designed that. And it is catchy. It's a little different. And it's actually, she didn't know this, but when I was a MLRSA TACAMS commander, my slogan for my battery was "Deploy, Fight, and Win." And but she used that "Deploy." And it's the idea is to send me to Washington and to help get our country back on track.
Do you think that Deploy Malloy has more legs than Deploy, Fight, Win as a political slogan?
I do. I think people like it. I've had foreigners come up and tell me, I really like that. And so it's working.
Well, Gerald Malloy, Republican for U.S. Senate here in Vermont, thank you so much for taking the time with us today. Appreciate your perspective.
Thank you. If you would, please take a look at deploymalloy.com. I want to serve all Vermonters for a better future, and I hope to have your consideration and your vote. May the 14 stars shine bright, and may God bless America. Thank you.
The WCAX Election Podcast is sponsored by Homeport, a locally owned and operated business on the Church Street Marketplace with 4 floors full of everything you might need to make your house a home. We're here with Representative Peter Welch, Democrat for U.S. Senate. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
You're a familiar figure for followers of Vermont politics, but for listeners who don't know you, could you tell us a little bit about your background?
Well, I am a Vermonter through and through. I can't say I was born here, but I've lived here all my adult life, and I love every moment of it. I began as a lawyer, public defender in White River Junction, Vermont. When I got out of law school, I had a chance to work on K Street in Washington or Wall Street in New York, and I made the right choice. I came to Breach Street in White River. I served in the state Senate 2 different times, and of course have served as Vermont's member of Congress since 2007. And every day that I do that job, I feel so blessed that I have an opportunity to be helpful to Vermonters.
What issues do you believe are at top of mind for voters this election day?
Well, the top of mind is we've got to save our democracy. And we have to save our democracy because the major challenges that we face in this country, addressing climate change, addressing affordability, the cost of housing, inflation, how it's tough on families, childcare, how we're going to protect reproductive freedom for women in light of the Supreme Court decision, the terrible Dobbs decision. We have to protect and preserve our democracy for the free and fair elections and the peaceful transfer of power. The democracy is the key because it's the tool we use to resolve these challenges that we always have in a society. And that democracy after January 6th is under threat.
What about issues that might not be top of mind for voters, but that you're focused on?
You know, a lot of the things that I've worked on come right out of my day-to-day listening and visiting with Vermonters. I mean, one of the big ones, prescription drugs. The cost of prescription drugs is brutal. You know, insulin that costs the manufacturers $10 to make, they charge $300 a month to fulfill a prescription. And I'm very proud that in Congress, we were finally able to pass price negotiation, which is something that I've been championing for 16 years. And we will be capping for Medicare the cost of insulin at $35. Burn pit legislation. You know, a couple of wonderful Vermont women whose husbands died as a result of cancers that they contracted when serving in Iraq and Afghanistan and were exposed to burn pits. They championed Pat Cram, June Heston, Laura Alexander legislation to provide healthcare benefits to our soldiers who were exposed to burn pits, no questions asked. And I was the lead sponsor on that. And I'm so proud of the work that these Vermont widows did in memory of their husbands. Those are just two examples. The climate change legislation that we passed, finally, we're going to have governmental policy with incentives that are going to create a dynamic in the marketplace where we can be working together, the public and private sector, to bring down the destructive explosion of carbon emissions. So there's enormous work to be done. But if we're going to get it done, we have to have a mutual respect that is part of a sustainable democracy. And that's what's been breaking down as exemplified by January 6th.
Congressman Welch, you were a founding member of the Problem Solvers Caucus. Is it correct that you're no longer a member?
Yeah, when I got appointed to the Intelligence Committee, the meetings that we had in the Intelligence Committee were in direct conflict. I wasn't able to continue going to the meetings. But I am very, very much of the continued mind that we have to work together in a bipartisan way to address our challenges. And of course, you know, I come out of Vermont, as you know, the Vermont Senate, and we always work together. When I was Senate president, and I served actually with Governor Scott, then Senator Scott, I appointed him to chair a committee, even though he was in the other party. And that's an approach I've taken with me to Washington. And that's a reason why I was one of the original people in Problem Solvers. I thought it made a lot of sense to get Republicans and Democrats to have conversations and do things together. So I'd continue that. But I was disappointed that because of my appointment to the Intelligence Committee, the schedule conflict was just constant.
And you're a member of the Progressive Caucus, is that correct?
It is correct. That's right. I, my predecessor, Senator Sanders, then Congressman Sanders, was a member, and I became a member when I first went to Congress.
Looking at the composition of the Progressive Caucus and the Problem Solvers Caucus, you know, Problem Solvers, you've got your Joe Manchins, you've got your centrists on one side, and then in the Progressive Caucus, you've got, well, progressives, you know, are those in conflict? Are those incompatible at all?
Well, here's really my approach on politics. I like to find areas where there's a problem, and then I need allies to solve it. Let me give an example. We didn't have broadband in Vermont. We're finally getting it. And I needed allies. And what I found is that in a rural state, we had the worst broadband. I started talking to colleagues, and most of my Republican colleagues support rural districts. And we then created the Broadband Caucus. I was an original creator of that. And we got half Democrats and half Republicans, most of us from rural districts, where we shared the goal of providing our constituents with better broadband. that's an approach that I take. So whether it's progressives or it's problem solvers or it's liberal Democrats or conservative Republicans, I don't get into ideological fights with them when I'm trying to help Vermont. I ask them, hey, we need to lower prescription drug costs. We have soldiers who are suffering from burn pit exposure. Hey, we have the need for telehealth. And then I create common ground with them on solving that specific problem. And by the way, that approach cuts across Democratic and Republican lines.
Do you believe that the Democratic Party is moving to the left?
You know, I just don't get into that. For me, what's important as Vermont's member of Congress is that I'm always moving in the direction of trying to help address the challenges that Vermonters have. And virtually everything I've gotten involved in has come from me interacting with Vermonters, from businesses that like small gas stations were getting ripped off by credit card fees. And I've become a champion of trying to get lower credit card charges because our merchants pay literally the highest transaction fees in the world, to the burn pit legislation, where I met widows in Vermont who were horrified that their husbands who suffered from cancer were denied Veterans Administration benefits. That is outrageous. And when I find out what these problems are, I then work with anybody and everybody in Congress. And by the way, as a Vermonter, I mean, you know, I'm the only member of Congress from Vermont. So I have a delegation of one. And what that means is I have to get allies in order to be successful helping Vermonters solve their issues. And that's the approach I took when I was in the state Senate. It's the approach I take in Congress.
And to follow up on that, Congressman, in other interviews for this podcast, both Governor Phil Scott and Lieutenant Governor candidates have told us that they believe that both the Democratic and the Republican parties are moving toward the extremes. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, yeah, there's a lot. That certainly is, I think, evident. I mean, let me put that in context, first of all. As an individual who serves as a legislative representative for Vermont, my job is to be practical and effective. And whatever way the parties are going, I have to keep my eye on how do I help Vermont. Number two, what we're seeing is two things. One, there's a much more, and this is a function of gerrymandering, where you get more extreme candidates on both sides. But here's what is really worrisome to me. We need two strong, vibrant parties in this country for the betterment of our whole society. And what I see with the influence of Donald Trump is that Republican Party and its traditional principles that are quite solid have been morphed into something that is all about Donald Trump and his self-aggrandizement. And I think that's been very destructive. And what you see there is, and again, epitomized by January 6th, is a collapse of the norm that this country has enjoyed through Republican and Democratic administrations of the peaceful transfer of power and the acknowledgement that it's the citizens who decide who their leader is, not politicians. So I think there's an extremism that is exhibited by Trump that has threatened the Republican Party adhering to what have been solid principles of small government, lower taxes, and personal responsibility. This party has become controlled by Trump, where like 70% of the folks who voted for Trump continue to deny that the election was won by Joe Biden. And right now we've got 100 candidates for over 100 candidates for U.S. Senate, for Congress, for governor on the Republican side that adhere to the Trump position that it was a stolen election. That's really bad for democracy.
What is the way to lower the temperature on these discussions or to soften the rhetoric and try and bring people together?
Well, my approach is to be focused on concrete things where if we make progress, it's going to be good for you, whether you voted for Trump or you voted for Biden, where there's mutual respect and adherence to the democratic norms that we've all enjoyed. But I'll give an example. during the pandemic, we actually provided significant childcare help to parents. And every parent, whether they voted for Trump or voted for Biden, they care about their kids. And that was good for everyone. The infrastructure bill. You know, there's an intersection in Barrie where the granite trucks come down from the quarries up on the hill, and parents meet those trucks when they're bringing their kids to school. And we had an event where we celebrated that that is going to be made safer. And you know what? Trump parents and Biden voting parents, they all care about their kids. So my approach is to try to find these things where if we're successful in making improvements, accessible childcare, safer intersections, it's really good for all of us. That creates trust and creates unity. And that's the approach I've taken really throughout my political career.
This year's report from the Social Security Board of Trustees said that the trust fund surpluses that fund Social Security benefits will be depleted by 2035. What does the future of Social Security look like for you?
Well, number one, we have to absolutely rock solid guarantee that Social Security will be there forever. I mean, that is a lifeline for seniors. It's been the most successful program we've had going back to the New Deal. From time to time, we have to make adjustments in how we fund it and what the benefits are. And of course, the last time that was done, it was done on a bipartisan basis with President Reagan and then Speaker Tip O'Neill. And I'm totally open to doing whatever we have to in order to make sure the solvency is guaranteed. And it should be done on a bipartisan basis, because that program is absolutely essential for the well-being of Trump voters who are seniors and Biden voters who are seniors. It's a really good example of what I'm talking about, where we have a common challenge. Let's work together to solve it.
It seems, though, that there's a gap between where, you know, Republicans and Democrats are in Congress over how to do this. There's been talk of privatization. What actually, you said you'd be willing to do whatever it takes. What does that mean? Are we talking about partial benefits, if that's what it takes? What does that mean?
No. Well, first of all, let's put this in context. Senator Scott from Florida, who is the head of the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee, is in favor of privatizing Social Security. That's a disaster. I mean, look at what's happened to the market this year. It's down 20%. So that means we're going to subject our seniors who are in fixed incomes to a 20% cut? No way. I am absolutely adamantly opposed to that. Second, he's saying we ought to vote on it in Congress basically every 5 years as to whether to renew it. I mean, that is just a stalking horse for privatization. I'm against that. What I'm in favor of is making certain that A, we have it, B, the benefits are adjusted to keep up with inflation, and the mechanisms that we've done to accomplish that are whatever the payroll deductions are, and also raising the income threshold to which Social Security benefits are applied to. So those are areas that I think make sense that would maintain benefits, guarantee solvency, and give seniors the confidence and the security that the Social Security benefits will be there.
Congressman, Vermonters continue to see rising healthcare costs across the board. If elected, what would you do as a senator to give them access to quality, affordable healthcare?
Well, first of all, the threat to access to healthcare is the brutal cost increases. And number one, pharmacy costs are the fastest rising component of healthcare. And that's why I fought so hard so long to get price negotiations so that our government could protect our consumers against price gouging by pharma. And that example I gave of it costs for insulin, which affects so many of our citizens, young and old, it costs $10 to manufacture the insulin, and they oftentimes charge $300. We finally are getting price negotiation where we'll cap it at $35. The second area is that there's a lot of hedge funds out there that are taking over elements of healthcare, like emergency room practices. They don't care at all about sustainable cost. They care about maximum profits. I really start looking into the hedge fund industry and how it's adversely affected affordability in healthcare. So this question of the cost of healthcare has to be addressed because it's brutal on individuals, it's brutal on taxpayers, and it's brutal on our employers. You know, Vermont employers want to treat their employees right, and they really want to provide healthcare benefits, but they have no control over these brutal premium increases that are getting stuck with every year. So the cost side of healthcare is where I would continue to focus an immense amount of my energy.
Speaking of energy, speaking of energy, climate change is a huge priority for many Vermonters. There's no silver bullet here, obviously, but what projects or big ideas would you support to try and meet the challenge of climate change?
Well, finally, Congress, with the Inflation Reduction Act, passed a major environmental piece of legislation to address and bring down carbon emissions. And here's what's so terrific about it. I mean, it's about $380 billion, and it's everything from energy efficiency to help us retrofit our homes and save money by using less fuel, something I championed, to trying to make electric vehicles affordable for everyday Vermonters, to trying to build out our charging stations so that people can have confidence who drive an electric vehicle that they'll be able to get from where they are to where they need to go and back, almost like when we were going from horse and buggy to the internal combustion engine, that people need a gas stations. So with this major governmental commitment on having policies that provide incentives, we're starting to unleash the private market so that you can have that public-private partnership that are going to move us towards a clean energy that's affordable. That's really what we have to do. And by the way, in the process of that, we're going to create a lot of jobs. One of the things you have to have for climate change and clean energy is battery storage technology. We've got a company in Waterbury, Vermont, Core Technologies, that is producing these huge batteries that are going to be used by ski areas, by Green Mountain Power, that allow us to store electricity created by, say, solar or wind, and then have it on demand when that energy is required. So this is a major breakthrough, because for the entire time I've served in Congress, there's been resistance to government having policies that are going to unleash the private market. And this legislation on climate change that we passed is a beginning, and we've got to keep accelerating that.
Are there any climate or green power projects that you wouldn't support, or that might be a bridge too far?
Well, I wouldn't be specific. I think there's always a siting question: where, when, and how. Those are the particulars that are always have to be worked out. And by the way, I think most of those have to be worked out in the local level. But I think that that's true for any kind of siting of any kind of project. You know, that was oftentimes a challenge with the with refineries. And what you saw in the past is an awful lot of times low-income communities were the ones that bore the brunt of the siting burdens. So I'm not about saying what are winners and losers. I mean, any kind of clean energy, any kind of efficiency technology, building and improving our transmission grid, which is really essential. All of those are things that have to be done on the local level, but in order for them to be done, you have to have incentives that make it affordable. Because the bottom line here, I think people all know, hey, let's move to clean energy, but it's got to be affordable for an everyday person. So in order to be successful, we have to make it affordable. We're not going to sell this because it's, quote, the virtuous thing to do. It's got to be the affordable thing to do.
Does nuclear energy have a place in our power portfolio?
It could. Yeah, it could. You know, with the new technologies, not the old technologies that are super expensive, an immense amount of waste, no answer for the waste storage, the kind of reactors at Fukuyama and the one we had here at Vermont Yankee, there's not a place for them. But what you're seeing is the development of technology where there's much smaller, locally based potential a nuclear power type of generation. So if that can be done in a way that's affordable, doesn't put the taxpayers on the hook, and done safely, I'm open to it. You know, let's see how the technology goes. But I don't have an absolute against any kind of practical, affordable and sustainable nuclear energy.
Vermont's senators, they chair and have chaired some of the most influential committees in the Senate. Are there any particular committees that you hope to serve on should you be elected?
Well, you know, there's a lot I'd like to serve on. We're going to have to see how it works out. So I don't want to get presumptuous. But, you know, we've, of course, been blessed with Senator Leahy, who served as the chair of the Appropriations Committee. And he had special outsized influence in the Senate. And no one's going to be able to replace him. I hope to succeed him. But the areas of interest that I've had are really consistent with the committee I served on, the committees I served on in the House. On energy and commerce, we had jurisdiction over climate change, healthcare, telecommunications, broadband, telehealth. These are things that I worked on and I want to continue working on in the United States Senate. And of course, I also served, do serve on the Intelligence Committee. And that committee is extremely important with respect to our national security, but also to democracy issues with all the evidence we have about the increase in interference in our elections with Russian propaganda. So in the Senate, whatever committees I ultimately serve on, my goal would be to continue advocating on these areas of jurisdiction because they matter a lot to Vermonters.
Over the course of the pandemic, we've seen overdose deaths surge nationwide. Much of that can be attributed to the availability of fentanyl. What can the Senate do to reduce the amount of fentanyl in circulation?
Well, first of all, what you said is absolutely right, unfortunately. I mean, the number of fentanyl deaths has exploded well over two or three times from what it was only a short few years ago. And it's tragic for the individuals who give up and die as a result of a fentanyl overdose. And it's really, really hard on the families who lose a loved one. And of course, a lot of this also has its origins in the extraordinary abuse by Purdue Pharma of its sales and peddling of the legal narcotic OxyContin. It's not an easy answer, but it's a bipartisan approach. You know, on the Energy and Commerce Committee, we passed oftentimes by unanimous Republican and Democratic support efforts to provide treatment for folks who have an addiction issue. We've seen in Vermont a lot of our providers take on this challenge to try to have a harm reduction approach and encourage folks without to come in without stigma. We've seen private citizens who created Jenna's House up in Johnson, Vermont. And I would continue as a senator to do all I did as a member of the House of Representatives to support treatment efforts, to do everything we can to try to help folks who are dealing with the plague of addiction.
And we're here with Representative Peter Welch, Democrat for U.S. Senate. I have another question before we let you go, Representative Welch. We're seeing right now Southern state Republican governors ship migrants north to places like Martha's Vineyard, to D.C., to New York. Is there a path forward for a bipartisan for a solution to these immigration problems? We are seeing a large number of migrants streaming over the border. What does a solution at the border look like to you?
Well, first of all, it has to be bipartisan. And we do have a real, real challenge at the border. I mean, it's a record number of folks coming across. A lot of them are coming from really authoritarian states like Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. And it's desperate people who had middle-class lives and no longer have them because of what those governments are doing. But it's a real challenge. And in order for us to address this, ideally, it would be bipartisan. And in fact, some years ago, there was a bipartisan immigration reform bill that had the dual goals of securing the border, but also having a pathway to legal citizenship with legal immigration. And it was supported by people from Patrick Leahy to John McCain. And I was prepared to vote for that in the House of Representatives, but then Speaker Boehner refused to bring that up even for a vote. But my view, we've got to get back to that, because what we have is a necessity to have a secure border on the one hand, and number two, to have a legal mechanism by which we can have immigration that's going to help us be the country we've always been, a nation of immigrants. But it's highly politicized, especially in the presidential year. I mean, you mentioned the what Governor DeSantis did. He sent a plane from Florida to pick up people under false pretenses in Texas, and that was all about advancing his presidential career. It was not about solving the immigration issue.
Representative Welch, thank you so much for being here today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We are back. Calvin, we just heard from the candidates. You heard Gerald Malloy speak about abortion, which is such a big issue as voters head to the polls this year. His response, leave it to the states. Is that the Republican Party line now?
I think specifically with abortion, it is. I think that the vote in Kansas a few weeks ago, whether abortion should be allowed in certain circumstances, in deep red Kansas, voters voted to allow it. And I think for a lot of Republicans, that changed the game, and it changed the messaging of how they approach abortion. But also, I think it's worth pointing out, leaving it to the states, that's always been part of the GOP and part of the Republican Party's main tenets, right? Small, limited government, fiscal responsibility, states' rights. Those have been themes that Republican candidates and the Republican Party have really turned to over the years. So I don't think this is anything new per se.
Abortion is an issue that we've seen a lot of energy around on the Democratic side of things. Is this leave it to the states Republican line enough to neutralize that energy on the Democratic side?
Maybe in some states. I don't know about here in Vermont. Certainly you've seen in other states Republicans have tried to distance themselves from the issue of abortion, trying to more so focus on the economy, inflation, gas prices, some of those kitchen table issues that they talk about.
Right.
But I don't know how that will necessarily play out here in Vermont, because Prop 5 is a Article 22, which will be on our November ballot. That's going to be a really big issue on the ballot. And actually, the WCAX poll, it also showed that over 75% of Vermonters also would like to see Prop 5 passed.
We also heard from Malloy about his decision to move to Vermont during the pandemic. We actually had a lot of reporting during the pandemic or the early stages about people leaving other parts of the country, leaving cities to move to rural Vermont. And when we were doing these, we had trouble sometimes finding characters to tell their story. How intentional then was it on Welch's part to say that he's a Vermonter through and through? Was he trying to draw a contrast between him and his opponent?
I don't know if it was intentional on Congressman Welch's part, but I think it's definitely a theme that we see played out time and time again. We've seen it this election cycle during the primaries. We saw it back in 2020, 2018. A lot of Vermonters, really like to tout, being a third, fourth, fifth generation Vermonter and really trying to connect with those Vermont roots. A lot of Vermonters, especially in rural parts of the state, there's a lot of issues and a lot of challenges that rural Vermont faces that people that have roots in Vermont, one could say that they understand and they get it. But it's also worth pointing out, though, that there are a number, and there's many, many elected leaders in Vermont that bring a fresh perspective to the table and that do really good work in communities trying to understand those issues. So it's one of these questions that comes up from time to time, from time and time again in Vermont politics about nativism, if you will, about what it means to be a Vermonter.
In our talk with Congressman Welch, he cast himself as a centrist, essentially saying, hey, if what you're selling helps Vermont, then I'm open for business. We talked about the Problem Solvers Caucus, Progressive Caucus, the Broadband Caucus. The guy likes his caucuses. Elsewhere, we've heard him characterized as further to the left. Vermont GOP chair Paul Dame mentioned him in the same breath as the Squad. Which of these characterizations is correct?
I think it depends on the day, and I think, you know, I think Congressman Welch put it the best when we asked about, you know, whether the party is moving to the left. And he said that his job as Vermont's congressman is to be practical and to be effective. And I think in terms of whether that means sometimes you're working with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or you're working with the Broadband Caucus, or the Problem Solvers Caucus, or working with Republicans across the aisle, I think from Congressman Welch's perspective, and his leadership style, he'll work with just about anybody, he says, whether that be somebody, you know, on the far left in the Progressive Caucus or elsewhere on the political spectrum. Folks that I've talked to within the State House back when Congressman Welch, back when he was Senator Welch as the president pro tem, they said that was very much his leadership style, trying to work collaboratively with others. So I think depends on the day, but all of those descriptions could be accurate.
One similarity between these two candidates, both of them mentioned wanting to basically unleash the private sector on climate change and let it get to work. That sounds good. If everybody wants this, what forces keep that from happening when it's time to actually do something?
To act on climate change.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the biggest issues, I think, that's certainly facing not just candidates. I mean,
because it's a safe answer either way, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, to say, let's unleash the power of American innovation on this problem and see if that can't, you know, if that, oh, I like American innovation, I'd vote for that.
Yeah, well, I think the question is, you know, in to what degree the government should be involved and, you know, passing stimulus and passing subsidies, really, and help for that private innovation and for the private sector to really get off the ground. Of course, Congressman Welch, he is really touted his record on passing the Inflation Reduction Act, which of course has really big investments in both healthcare, but also in climate change mitigation. Same with the American Rescue Plan as well. Those had, I mean, millions and millions of dollars toward EV infrastructure and clean water and wastewater. But you look at also, I think the other big rub is Gerald Malloy says that we should, you know, loosen restrictions on regulation and let the private market, let the private industry flourish in this way, and that we should not be spending money that we don't have. In his eyes, the national debt is a huge issue, and spending it and continuing to deficit spend on climate, he says, isn't the way forward. So I think that's really the biggest rub between the two, or the biggest difference right now, is just what role government and what role deficit spending plays in bolstering our climate initiatives.
Talking to both of these candidates, I thought that both of them did a good job staying on message. We heard Welch pivot to his record over and over again. We heard Malloy default to phrases like change for a better future, tough choices for a better future. We even heard him plug his website at the end there, this kind of politics 101 type stuff. In your work, are there any other politician-isms that stand out to you, maybe when they're trying to either get you to cover a story, or maybe when they're trying to give you the brush off?
I think the one that I hear a lot is a politician for the people, or for the working Vermonters. I think that's one that we hear a lot from both Democrats, Republicans, independents, progressives. I think that's definitely one of them.
It's very it's this language that's just very broad. It's very inclusive. I think of myself as a working Vermont. You think of yours.
Yeah.
It's these tenets that people can sort of latch onto regardless of what they might think about different policies.
Yeah. And you definitely, I mean, part of that, the language there, whether we're talking about saying, you know, change for a better future, or tough choices for a better future, or, you know, working for working Vermonters, you know, those are all slogans, really, that, you know, you don't want to isolate voters and you don't want to alienate voters. So those are really welcoming messages that, you know, both Republicans and Democrats, they give off to try to bring voters in, try to, you know, say, hey, visit my website, explore the platform, see what my candidacy is all about.
All right, and we'll see how those messages pay off come Election Day. For the WCAX podcast, I'm Brett Miller.
And I'm Calvin Cutler.
The WCAX Election Podcast is sponsored by Homeport, a locally owned and operated business on the Church Street Marketplace with four floors full of everything you might need to make your house a home.